The amazing thing about a bicycle is, without even asking it to, it will expand your horizons. It will take you a little farther than you thought you would go. And when it does that, it produces for many people such a profound sense of satisfaction, a realization that you could do and see more than you thought you could.
That's my guest today. That's Pete Van Nuys. He's the director of the Orange County Bicycle Coalition here in Southern California. Pete and I, we cover a lot of ground today. We'll talk about safety issues. You're going to think it's like going to school. We'll talk about some of the topics that Pete covers in his bicycle safety classes that he leads. That's how I got to know Pete. I took one of his classes, and we've been pals ever since. Pete's spending quite a bit of time coming to the Newport Beach Bike Safety Commission meetings that commenced just last month. Pete Van Nuys on today's show. And I'm your host, Frank Peters, and you're listening to CDM Cyclist. It's a new blog. It's a new podcast show where I'm interviewing civic leaders, people like Pete Van Nuys, others who know about bike safety, how to build a improved infrastructure, how to influence public policy, all of those things, as we try to take back Southern California from the embrace of the automobile, maybe, huh? Well, that's my motivations. And so Pete Van Nuys, he's, of course, to be the director of the Orange County Bicycle Coalition, he knows it all, and I've been dying to get him on the show. So one beautiful morning, just a few weeks ago, I drove down to San Clemente, and, let's listen.
And Pete, you wanted to start off, you had a question for me. What was that again?
Question was, what was your interest in bicycling? What drives your interest in cycling?
Well, you know, I grew up, all people start that way. I had a bike as a kid. I did. And just a few times in my life, I've gotten really interested in that. I went to University of Oregon for 1 year. So that was like really immersing myself in a cycling culture. But then after a close call at UCLA graduate school with a lady in a Cadillac, I set my bike aside for many, many years. Okay, so then years later, I'm not getting enough exercise. My cholesterol numbers are going through the roof. I try a vegan diet. I do that for 2 years, and I complain to my brother-in-law that it's not working. You know, I'm not losing the weight. My numbers aren't going down like I thought, and it's a lot of effort, right? He says, I've got to get you on a bike. And that, just revelation from above, I threw myself into it and drove my numbers right into, you know, for me, the ground. My cholesterol, triglyceride numbers, fantastic. So that's what started. Once I get back on a bike, I've kind of analyzed it this way, Pete, is in every other aspect of my life, I'm treated with a certain amount of respect that I've come to enjoy and appreciate. When I'm out there on a bicycle, people blow their horn at me, flip me the bird, curse me and my wife riding down the street. Oh, I didn't like that. So I get, you know, a little like wanting to fight for, you know, a better treatment on the roads. Can you relate to any of that, Pete?
Certainly. It all just comes down to user group conflict. It's the same kind of circumstance that you find if you are hiking in the wilderness and a mountain bike goes by.
Yeah.
The mountain bike and the pedestrian may not actually come into conflict, but the fact that the pedestrian notices the bicycle and feels that they have to step out of the way, or they expect the bicyclist to yield.
And that illustrates. And if any words are shared during the experience, too, that could be considered rude, right? When you're out there in the woods and somebody shouts at you, "Look out!"
Sure, possibly. The difference that I've experienced working trail maintenance is, you know, you drop your bicycle and you carry your tools down the trail, and you're working with your crew there, and a bicyclist goes by. And it should be all simpatico. I mean, we're working on behalf of their activity. And yet there's something about the freedom that the bicycle has, the ability to appear and disappear in a manner so unlike your own, being restricted to 2 feet. It simply illustrates, even on a subconscious level, that you are two different creatures at that time.
Right.
And so you put individuals in automobiles and were brought up in an auto culture where you are taught that you are the king of the road. And then you see another user there in what many people would like to consider, have been told to consider their space.
Yeah.
And so that's where that tension comes in, I think.
Yeah. I read a book about traffic. It's on my blog.
Mm-hmm.
The author describes all of our, you know, different behaviors. And, you know, when construction signs say, right lane ends, merge left ahead, do you pull over into the left-hand lane right away? Or do you try to squeeze it out until the last possible moment? All of those kinds of behaviors. And he does come up with the right answer, but he also speaks of like the anonymous nature of, you know, being behind the wheel, completely encapsulated. It's easy to, not always the best behaviors come out, I guess, as a result, was his point.
Yeah. True.
Now, Pete, a little background for the audience. You and I met earlier this spring. I was about to start cycling merit badge with the Boy Scouts, and somehow I found out about you. And you do a bicycle training class. What's the name of that class again, Pete?
Well, officially, it's the League of American Bicyclists Traffic Smart 101, part of the Cycle Smart series that the League promotes. It's a curriculum that has evolved over the last 30-plus years from John Forrester's Effective Cycling curriculum, which he wrote in the late 70s. John Forrester was the first person to take what was known about bicycling, what club cyclists from Great Britain and France and America had been using to promote safety and efficiency for decades, and actually turn it into a text. He was an instructor, a college professor himself, and so he wrote a very...
So he knew how to put together a curriculum.
Exactly, yeah, lesson plans. And originally it was written to be taught in a high school or junior college environment over a full semester, so it was originally written as an 11-week course.
Oh, wow.
And when I started teaching it in the 1980s, it was an 11-week course, and it was very exhaustive. I mean, it basically covered everything from... much more detailed bicycle maintenance, more detailed than we go into now for sure, a lot of politics, because law is ultimately the product of a political process.
I can picture Pete over an 11-week time period dealing with the kids too. Kids would have a chance to learn something, practice it, and you'd have a chance to like pull them halfway through, three quarters of the way through, and get some like acknowledgement of what they're learning.
Yeah, we 1 year, well 2 years actually, we chartered an explorer post in Huntington Beach, and offered the program sponsored by Two Wheel Transit Authority. Ran the classroom or the curriculum portion as the content, and the reward was a series of advancing rides, day rides, and ultimately overnight rides and things. So it became kind of a bicycle club. We fostered a lot of good habits in those young people.
Sure.
And it was a very rewarding experience because, of course, scouting includes the parents, which is terrific. Because one of the things we really need to do is educate adult bicyclists as to how to ride like adults and not like children.
So after I completed Cycling Merit Badge, and I borrowed a lot of your concepts, right? We practice braking for 15 minutes before we head out on a ride, and emergency stops, and something simple like pedal up so that at a busy intersection they're ready to go with their foot in the toe clips maybe and pedal up. So very satisfying, you know, stop at every stop sign. And then after the class, I'm back out there with my buddies, these adult cyclists, and I'm stopping again, and they're, you know, flying right through intersections, and I'm like ready to shout at them as I would a kid, right? But that's not going to go over so well, I know, so I bite my tongue anyway.
But. Oh, don't stifle. we need to, as responsible cyclists, stand up for what's right.
I'm still dealing with that issue. I can picture that precisely. I know, I remember who it was, John, and where we were, Balboa Island, and a lot of law enforcement in that neighborhood, not a good place to blow through a stop sign. Well, I was really moved by the experience, Pete, I guess, and so I've revered you. You've got a special place in my consciousness as being my bicycle coach. And you passed me, I know, I got through it by the skin of my teeth. I remember, if you don't, I do remember. I had, as an adult maybe, I had a challenge doing some of the like emergency maneuvers that you were teaching us. That did not come easy for me.
Well, do you still practice those?
No.
You should. You should, you know.
I know it.
Every ride you have, or any ride that you have that you regularly take, if there's a stop sign, make that your instant stop practicing position. Mm-hmm. Any unrestricted left turn or right turn that you might make, make that your instant turn practicing location.
Right.
And
right.
All of nature's little spots on the street, pick a few and practice your rock dodging.
Yeah, right. So that emergency right turn, would you explain what it's, so in case a car turns right in front of you, right?
That's right. The right hook, which is the famous problem where a car will accelerate to get by the bicyclist and then jam on the brakes and cut right. The proper maneuver on behind the car's proper maneuver or behavior would be just slow down for a couple of seconds, let the bicyclist go through.
Yeah, right.
But car culture tells us that for reasons we can't really justify, the car must always pass the cyclist. So to avoid being right-hooked, if you're approaching an intersection and a car goes by you on your left, you need to have a little red flag, at least partially raised, because if he cuts right suddenly, you're going to need to be able to cut even tighter right inside him. And that's where the emergency or the instant turn comes in. And that's a skill that has to be automatic. You can't be thinking your way through what, now I counter steer, now I wait the inside bar, now I wait the outside pedal, now I look up and through where I want to go. It just has to happen.
Right, right. Well, that is good advice then. I've got to be practicing that. The next like milestone in our relationship was you started showing up at the Newport Beach convened just about a year ago, the like a bike safety task force.
Nancy Gardner,
Councilwoman Nancy Gardner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's quite a ways from home for you. What were your motivations to come on out?
Well, as OCBC, Orange County Bicycle Coalition director, I have an interest, a responsibility to find out what's going on behalf of bicycling in communities. We have, 32 incorporated cities in Orange County? Cities certainly have the largest, most profound impact on the lives of their citizens. State and county law have very little effect, but city infrastructure, city ordinance, the priorities that city councils set for quality of life in the city, that's what really defines what it's like to live and, in this case, bicycle there. So we were very interested in what Nancy Gardner's objectives were,
sure.
And we applaud her efforts and the efforts of the city. I'm very impressed with what Newport Beach wants to do, and they may wind up being the third bicycle-friendly community in Orange County.
Who's number one and two, Pete?
Well, the first chronologically was Irvine.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
And right. And they sailed through basically on their infrastructure.
They were building it. They were building the whole community, Irvine Company, and
bike lanes, for instance, are seen as an amenity which sells houses.
Right. Yeah.
They also have what are called paseos in some communities, ways to walk or bicycle through neighborhoods that are not on the street. Another very attractive amenity. Those are, in fact, shared-use trails, so they will rate very high in terms of physical facilities for cycling.
They had that great advantage of being aware that that was going to be valuable in terms of selling homes and, with a clean slate, empty land to implement that. It's much harder for all these other cities to retrofit. Obviously.
Well, Huntington Beach is number two chronologically. They have a rather complete network of Class 2, which are on-street bike lanes. Most of the major arterials have included bike lanes for decades. Huntington Beach is also relatively flat. It's easy to bicycle around Huntington Beach.
Yeah, it is. It is.
They have the bike and pedestrian path on the beach. It's very attractive.
Right. And later, that's my favorite route. I'm on that route like Monday, just 2 days ago. I'm working my way along that route because it's quiet and no cars and scenery to die for.
Off season on a weekday.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's great. It's idyllic. Yeah. How far up do you ride?
Well, I often, like this day, I went up from Corona Del Mar to Huntington Beach for lunch.
The pier?
Into town.
Mm-hmm.
I ride into town then. And then my brother has his boat at Peter's Landing way up in, is that Sunset Beach? That's a 17-mile one-way, 34-mile round trip for me. That's
Huntington
a good
Harbor.
Ride. Yeah, way up at the mouth of Huntington Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good ride for me.
So it's 34 round trip for you?
34 round trip.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah.
Excellent. So you're on PCH part of the way.
Actually, I can do that without getting on PCH at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the next step, the next leg, you have to take PCH to get into Seal Beach. And for the Boy Scouts, they had to do their 50-mile round trip ride. We went to the aquarium in Long Beach, and that was the one chunk of Coast Highway we had to deal with. But they were prepared.
Through Anaheim Bay.
Anaheim Bay, right.
Right, over the bridge and all that.
Right.
Yep.
So Huntington Beach, you look at Huntington Beach and you say they're naturally gifted, right? Wide boulevards, flat. You could, if you were so inclined to designate one street a bicycle street, the motoring public could just go one block over and avoid it if they cared to. It's a grid. So then along comes Newport Beach, and we are, kind of squeezed along the coast. We're challenged that we don't have a lot of alternate routes. Coast Highway is the major. Would you agree, Pete, that we've got a lot of traffic going up and down Coast Highway trying to get to the other beach cities?
Sure. That's the situation for all of the beach towns in Orange County.
Yeah.
PCH is the route. And if you live here, sometimes you find yourself kind of limited about your recreational cycling. Where am I going to go this weekend? Up PCH or down PCH is often the question.
That's the problem living next to the coast. You don't have that other dimension, right, to travel in.
Yeah. So it's important that bicyclists reestablish their acceptance on Pacific Coast Highway, because there is no alternate route. Traditionally, it has been the north-south connection between Canada and Mexico, between L.A., Orange, and San Diego counties. It's absolutely essential. Where you have pinch points like Dana Point and San Clemente, where you're trapped between the ocean and coastal bluffs, then you're right back to that narrow trail user conflict kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. I would rate Laguna Beach, pedaling through Laguna Beach. There are very few even share the road signs in Laguna Beach.
Laguna is an interesting problem because it is narrow there. It's made more narrow by the business district.
Yeah.
For a long time, Laguna Beach government didn't even want to acknowledge that there were bicyclists there. Apparently, someone had counseled them that from a liability standpoint, if they acknowledged bicycles, they would be required to take some kind of responsibility for them. The alternative to PCH is Cliff and Forest and Glen Eyre, and they never wanted to designate that officially as a bike route through town. So a lot of bicyclists simply use PCH.
Right.
And if you ride on it properly, you really don't have a problem. I know a lot of people are afraid to get out there, but if they ride like adults, if they ride like they are driving a vehicle, they won't really have any problems.
Now, a lot of my listeners, I'll bet, I'm just guessing now, probably assume they know what you mean, but I feel like I know what you really mean. When driving like an adult, you often use the analogy, the phrase, a gravel truck, Pete. What's that analogy mean?
The short answer is if you drive like the driver of a cement truck, a professional who has charge of a vehicle that stops slowly, that accelerates away from lights slowly, that requires him to plan his maneuvers across other lanes of traffic, left turns, right turns, in advance, carefully, in a professional manner, to signal his intent and to not be flustered by the impatience of the motorists around him. To make a mistake driving a ready-mix concrete truck is to leave a lot of concrete on the pavement.
Like collateral damage.
Yeah. And one can't afford to be late delivering that load.
You're due on site
at a particular time. And so, like the driver of a cement truck, a bicyclist commuting to work, for instance, needs to be to work on time. We can't afford to dilly-dally with circuitous alternate routes. We can't be flustered by the expressed or latent impatience of the motorists around us. They are responsible for operating their vehicles in a safe manner, and we are responsible for operating our bicycles in a safe manner. And if we all do that, we can tolerate each other, if not get along.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence of sharing the road. Sharing the road cuts both ways.
So I remember now in the 2 day, it's a Friday night and then all day Saturday, traffic skills 101 class. You take us on like a 15-mile ride, if I remember. And at one part, you take us through construction on an overpass over train tracks or a freeway in Irvine. And so we have to negotiate our way into the right-hand lane there and command the lane. There's not enough room to pass. I know you were scoring us on that part. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, you got to take the lane.
Take is an awfully aggressive word. Yeah. I don't like to use the word take.
Okay.
That's a popular word in the league literature.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer the word occupy the lane. You know, if you're occupying a chair, people don't normally come along and expect you to get out of it. If you're occupying the stall in the men's room, unless you're a senator, you don't normally come along.
Okay, we get it, Pete.
Okay.
But there's the analogy anyway, is, and like dealing with the scouts, they were reluctant. You know, they're young men. That was something I had to drill them on. And I would take them on purpose to certain parts of town where they had to occupy the lane.
That requires the other road users to either straddle pass or move completely out of the lane to pass you safely.
Right.
And so if in your mind you're a cement truck at the time, there's nothing exceptional about that at all.
Yeah.
So that's the gravel truck
now,
analogy.
The opposite approach is, I see this in Corona Del Mar all the time, it's probably like neighborhoods in Laguna and elsewhere, where there's two lanes of southbound traffic. That's what I seem to notice. And a lane, you know, and then parked cars along the curb and cyclists, I call it threading the needle, you know, flirting with getting doored. If you're not occupying the lane and you're still moving through traffic, that's the alternative, right? Threading the needle, is that a term that others use?
Well, we call them gutter bunnies.
Gutter bunnies, yeah.
Yeah. Gutter bunny behavior is the behavior that your mother asks you to demonstrate when you're a six-year-old. Stay out of the way of the cars.
Yeah.
Watch for the cars. The cars are going to get you. In fact, if you're bicycling like an adult, they don't get you. What gets you is the unconscious driver opening the door in front of you.
Right.
Statistically, the overtaking motorist is responsible for about 4% of the car-bike incursions, collisions. Dooring is just as likely to occur. It's also around a 4%. But dooring is actually much more serious because not only do you encounter the door or win the door prize, as they say, but you're inevitably thrown left into traffic where then you'll be run over at whatever the closing speed of the automobile is. When you hit the pavement, presumably you're doing zero. Traffic is 20. You're going to be run over at 20 miles an hour, which is probably going to kill you.
A lot of these neighborhoods we're talking about, speeds would be 35 or higher.
If you are bicycling, however, where you belong, and a car passes you too closely, and you're nicked by a mirror, the closing speed is the difference between the two.
Right.
If you're doing 15 and traffic is doing 30, the mirror hits you at 15 miles an hour. Now, neither one of those are attractive, but clearly the latter is preferential, and one has to think about these things when you're out there. You can avoid, actually, I believe, both of those circumstances by being visible and by being predictable, mm-hmm. by holding your line when you're riding in traffic.
Now, these behaviors we're talking about, I observe what I would say are, well, they certainly have the, you know, professional spandex outfits. I see cyclists of all, you know, levels of capability threading that needle or doing the gutter bunny. You see that too, right?
Well, again, bicyclists of all stripe, the most casually dressed and the Lance wannabe tired, if they have the echoes of mother's words in their heads, they will try to pass between the parked car and the cars on the right, and that's absolutely wrong. If you're moving faster than traffic in the right-hand lane, you need to move into the lane and occupy that lane behind the car in front of you. And to pass them, you would move to the left. And if it's clear, move into the number one lane and pass that traffic. You should never try to pass an automobile on the right. They're simply too unpredictable. Motorcyclists know this. People who...
I would say, yeah, I've never seen... seldom do I see a motorcycle do that. You're right.
Yeah.
They do know.
Yeah. We have a lot in common with motorcyclists, actually, when mm-hmm. we're bicycling, especially in traffic.
Mm-hmm.
We can share a lane, two side by side, which motorcyclists do frequently, without anyone becoming upset. If you have two bicyclists riding side by side in a lane, motorists often throw a tizzy.
Yeah. So does your local law enforcement officer sometimes, right?
Well, it gets very complex interpreting California yeah. Vehicle Code.
Yeah.
21202, what does that really mean? What does far to the right is practicable mean?
I often say I'm the judge of that, anticipating what I'm going to say when I get pulled over for being too far out in the lane, occupying the lane.
Well, if we can believe the chief of police of Newport, though, apparently that's not going to happen,
mm-hmm.
Provided we're responsible when we ride.
Well, you're speaking of Chief Jay Johnson, who recently joined the force chief in Newport Beach. He was on the job just a short while and convened an audience of all the bicycle enthusiasts in town. And I remember you were there. That was encouraging to hear his words that night.
Mm-hmm, indeed. I hope that if we can get bicyclists to behave like adults on their bikes in Newport Beach, that the law enforcement will respect us.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they will begin to enforce some of the laws that protect us.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice.
So we've got a lot of education to do. I made a note here. I'm scribbling a couple of notes. I went up to San Francisco, drove up there in a car, threw my bicycle on the back, because I knew I was going to spend almost a whole week in downtown San Francisco. And I delighted in riding around because, that's a silver city, I think, San Francisco. A lot of sharrows, a lot of cyclists. I just enjoyed riding around downtown, making my, having to move left to make a left-hand turn across several lanes of traffic. It all worked great, but I was appalled. I saw so many stupid cyclists. You see that too, huh? There's a lot of education. It's not just marking up the roads and, building the infrastructure. It seems like we're way behind in educating the cycling public, Pete.
Well, that's very true. My number one priority through the Orange County Bicycle Coalition is to promote not just the TS, Traffic Smarts 101 program. The league has other classes in how to ride in groups, how to behave properly so we're not exhibiting mob behavior on the street.
How do you entice people to recognize the value in learning more about cycling, Pete?
We haven't figured that out yet, Frank. That's the number one.
Because your skills, people think that they have great skills because they remember how to ride as a kid. It's easy to get back on. You never forget. It's fun. And you go out there. I've heard you say before, you learn everything when you're 6 years old.
And then every time you get on a bike after that, you revert to being a six-year-old.
Yeah.
I see it all the time here in San Clemente
at
our location in the Metrolink building, because we're the convergence or divergence of three bike routes through town. And right there in front, you can see bicyclists coming and going onto El Camino Real, which is what we call Pacific Coast Highway here. Half the time they're riding against traffic. Rather than making a simple left-hand turn perpendicular to the road, the shortest possible route across that road, they will ride contraflow against traffic, highly dangerous behavior, putting everyone else in jeopardy. I see mothers with children in trailers doing this in the mistaken belief that they're being safe. It makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
Yeah, it does. And that is the 1113 coming through town. We're just a stone's throw from the train station here. And it is a gorgeous day in San Clemente. Anyway, this is going very nicely. And I'd like to continue, Pete. I've got just a few more thoughts here. I remember a time you were at one of the final meetings of the Newport Beach Cycling Safety Task Force, we called it. And I think we were wrapping up some list of recommendations that we were doing. And I must have shown it on my face that I was, a little bit frustrated that we weren't doing more, going faster, being more ambitious. And I remember you approaching and saying, Frank, influencing public policy takes time. And you said that with great consideration. I found it a great comfort. I haven't forgotten it since. You've had a lot of experience influencing public policy, Pete. You're a man of great patience.
I'm incredibly impatient.
You're in the wrong business.
I may well be. In the 1970s bike boom, which I remember quite vividly, the baby boom generation discovered bicycling. This created the explosion in the number of bike brands that we have today.
Oh, yeah, right.
Everyone had a 10-speed, and everybody took to the streets.
Right.
And then, as now, most of them rode like six-year-olds. Although actually the level of sophistication, the level of knowledge and acceptance of bicycling was actually greater in the 60s than it is today.
Why do you think that is?
Well, our parents' generation, the greatest generation, and the baby boom generation, for the most part, grew up bicycling and using it as transportation. A lot of us bicycled to school, elementary, junior high. Then, of course, we discovered cars, and you have that whole car culture reinforcement, part of that post-war great American prosperity thing. And that really became the dominant influence over the 70s and the 80s.
Like in that time period, I knew how to repair a wheel and align, you know, my wheels, which I haven't done. You know, I'd be hesitant to take apart my bike and do today. So I knew a lot more about bicycle maintenance at that time.
The children of baby boomers have grown up knowing the bicycle only as a toy. The last two generations of Americans are not permitted to bicycle to school. Bicycling and walking to school used to be very common. Today, kids are driven in their SUV. Mom takes them down to the store to get a bag of Skittles and rent a video game or something.
Yeah.
That was not the case when I was growing up. I had a bike. All my friends had bikes. We would ride down to the store. We rode all over the place.
We were a one-car family, so during the day, if you had to get someplace, that was your only option.
Exactly. And so America has lost two generations, I believe, of bicycle culture. And we're trying to get the bicycle culture back. And here it comes in a Marine helicopter.
Got all the sound effects today.
Yeah.
This is an authentic shooting on location, so to speak. Recording on location.
There you go. It's a very prestigious setting.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. We're in the swimming pool, public pool building here.
Foley Hansen Beach Club.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've lost two generations of bicycle culture. A lot of very well-meaning individuals during the 70s tried to react to this bicycle boom by creating bike facilities, which were primarily to get people out of the way of cars. It was primarily for the benefit of the motorist that bike lanes, bike paths, local ordinances were written. And a lot of that was absolutely terrible. We may remember bike lanes that ended abruptly at bridge abutments.
Yeah, right.
Bike lanes that routed people onto sidewalks. Well, we know statistically sidewalk riding can be 5.3 times more dangerous than riding on the street. But it was common to find signs which were not in compliance with the law that said bicycles must use sidewalk. All of that occurred during the 70s. And after the bike boom died down about 1978, it took knowledgeable, experienced bicycle advocates decades to undo a lot of that damage. Now we've entered an era where, for instance, Caltrans came out with Deputy Directive 64, which basically makes the concept of complete streets the state policy, where we're now trying to design facilities for all modes, pedestrians, bicyclists, and motor vehicles.
Is that a recognition of like quality of life issues? Is that what's motivating a new initiative like that, Pete?
I think it's a recognition that we live in a finite world, and there's only so much horizontal space in the right of way. And we've realized that to require people to get into a 2-ton metal object and burn gasoline to go half a mile to buy a quart of milk is dysfunctional.
Yeah.
But people feel unsafe going out in their own neighborhoods. Venture past your street out onto a collector street, and many people worry that they're going to be run over.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you address that concern? Because that is, I hear people say that all the time, Pete. Just got to encourage them to try it, take a friend for a ride, assure them somehow. What do you?
Well, definitely getting out on the street. For instance, if you have someone who is traffic averse, let's go for a ride when traffic is non-existent or very light.
Right.
Let's get used to riding on the street when there are no cars. And then let's investigate where the real risks are as opposed to where the myth about risk is. Remember your mother's voice. The cars are out to get you. The fact is the cars aren't out to get us.
It's bad for your insurance rates.
Exactly. Yes. It makes you late for Starbucks to run over
That's
a bicyclist.
Right. It is. All those reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly there are conditions or times when motorists behave badly, reach for a cell phone, drive drunk, distracted driving, and so on.
Yeah.
And those instances always make the newspapers, and that reinforces some of these fears.
Right.
But if you recall from the class, we examine some of the myths
right.
and some of the realities.
You've got all the statistics, Pete. I remember that. Like, you'd started off the class, I remember, the likelihood of getting run over from behind by a motor vehicle is...
It's less... Well, in the context of everything that can right. go wrong for someone hitting the road here on their bike, it's less than 1% of the things you actually need to worry about.
So, yeah, you can kind of set that concern aside.
In the context of even car... bicycle collisions, it's barely 4% of the things that can go wrong.
Now, a lot of people, like I just did a double take there, that's such a low number that strains credibility, Pete, when you share that number. Other people have the same reaction. Wow, that's a lot less than I thought.
I don't invent the stats.
Yeah,
you know, I just report them. And then,
so it's kind of like the perception of these concerns is much greater than the reality.
Well, for instance, those statistics come from the national stats that that the league is using in the current curriculum. Then when you look at another city that has gone through the bicycle-friendly surveys, and you look at their accident stats and their breakdowns, and Oceanside comes to mind because they did a very exhaustive study, and you find the parallel there to be extremely close. In other words, Oceanside's instance of overtaking motorist is right in that same 4% range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if you teach the behaviors that deal with that likelihood, you know, if we're worried about the overtaking motorist, what do we do about that? How do we become visible? How do we keep them from running into us from behind? If that's your number one boogeyman, and you do that by your lane position, by remaining visible in the day through what you wear, by using proper lighting at night, which is something that the vast majority of bicyclists don't do. We have tremendously effective headlights and taillights now.
Yeah.
Just in the last few years, the advancement in LED technology has been incredible.
They're super light. They need to be recharged like 3 times a year, the lights I use.
100 hours on a couple of AA batteries.
Yeah.
There's no excuse for people not being visible when they're riding their bikes anymore. Yet I see people going up the road at dusk wearing black. No lights. Yeah, it's amazing.
You're asking for it there, huh?
Yeah.
My guess is, though. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you a question. How do you think we can promote effectively the educational programs? And they don't have to be that particular class.
Well, I post this up. These will eventually be on iTunes as a podcast. So that's my answer to all the world's problems, I say, is, convening Americans in real time in a certain space, that's challenging for all kinds of organizations like theater mm-hmm. and going to the movies and going to take a class. People love, alternatives, I guess. So here, education, talking about these kinds of issues, disseminating it into iPhones and iPads and iPods.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to do it, huh?
Yes.
Better use of multimedia comes to mind.
For instance, OCBC purchased for LCIs an inventory of the textbooks and a graduation certificates,
mm-hmm.
which reduces the financial hurdle, at least, for league-certified instructors.
And I have my certification diploma, I call it, right? It's in my office, and everybody who walks in there can see it. I was pleased to, because I got by again by the skin of my teeth.
Your grades are in the permanent record in Washington, D.C. now, in the League of American Bicyclists headquarters. And if you wish to go forward and take 201 or any of the other classes, or I would encourage you to get your own LCI, League Certified Instructor certification. You can do that now because this is a real program with genuine legs and a national staff that's very concerned about just these issues that we're talking about.
Well, I'd be motivated to do that. You know, I told you I was doing cycling merit badge with the Boy Scouts, done other merit badges too. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that, how satisfying it was to teach the young men some skills and then take them out into the real world and nag at them, critique them, you know, real life examples. And then it was the feedback I got from some of the parents, though, that were accompanying their sons on the rides. I'll never forget one mother describing how she was looking for ways to spend more quality time with her son, and joining him on these cycling merit badge rides was such a thrill for her. I got a big hug.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah, that, you know.
Well, a side benefit to teaching young people that program is you're really giving them 90% of the content of driver's education. Because we're teaching people how to share the road as a legal road user and to take the responsibilities that go along with that. Another point you asked, bicycle advocacy is, I think, in a time of transition. We look at a lot of the physical facilities that go onto the road now, and there's a temptation to see those as the end product.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, for instance, the green paint in Long Beach, if that isn't just a transitional stage we're going through, that green paint symbolizes the citizens' right to use that public space with their chosen mode, which would happen to be non-motorized. And it reminds motorists that those people are there legitimately. And when the green paint wears away, the right to be there doesn't wear away. And I'm hoping that the cultural effect of bike boxes and green paint and some of these oddball facilities that get developed, I'm hoping that those ultimately will translate into the cultural change that is really the objective of bike advocacy.
Yeah, I'd be tempted to think, you know, everybody who drives over that green paint, and what we're talking about are the Sharrows and Belmont Shore, and if you listen to my interview a few weeks ago with Charlie Gandy, has been on the show, got an interview, and we talk extensively about the Sharrows and Belmont Shore and the green paint. I keep thinking that you're affecting, you know, having a bigger impact than you think with things like that, improvements. For example, I keep hoping someday we'll do something similar in Corona Del Mar, and I think all the traffic that's going through Corona Del Mar, some of it's going to South Laguna, Monarch Beach, Dana Point, some of that traffic, you'd have an opportunity to influence a lot of the motoring public, just increasing awareness of the cyclist's right to share the road.
We have to be careful with the message we send, though, to motorists, because it's the right to use that public space that is important, not the paint. It's easy for a motorist, through the eyes of car culture, to say, well, if the paint isn't there, the bicycle shouldn't be there either. And that's just not the case.
Kind of a reverse effect there.
And we know, for instance, that motorists will pass a bicyclist with less space if the bicyclist is in the bike lane than they will if there is no bike lane.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a common statistic, isn't it? I've heard that. I've read that too. Yeah. And whether or not he's wearing a helmet affects proximity too. So a bicyclist wearing a helmet, the driving public's inclined to shave him even more than somebody without. That's what I've read.
Yeah, yeah. So, we have to be careful when we rush to these facilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about I'd like to change gears, Pete, and spend a little bit of time getting to know you better. I'm curious. I jotted down a question. What's the longest ride you've ever done?
400 miles.
Yeah, what was that?
Well, the longest ride in a weekend, for instance, is San Francisco to L.A.,
Oh, that's a heck of a ride in one weekend.
The organization that I co-founded was called Vanderfogel Bicycle Touring Association, And we used to sponsor an event called the Great California Land Rush, where we'd fly people up to San Francisco, and ride would begin basically at San Francisco International and would complete at LAX. So it was SFO to LAX with an overnight in San Luis Obispo. It was consecutive double centuries. It was actually a little over 200 miles each day. A terrific ride, just an amazing ride. And
now you had to be in super shape to do 200 miles 2 days in a row.
Consecutive doubles, you have to be really fit.
You can't
fit.
Just go out and do that. Right? You got to prepare. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that was what made that weekend so amazing, because the people that you're riding with were all highly trustworthy individuals, and they were all stoked to be doing what they were doing. And the experience of doing that in a weekend is just amazing. Our route took us down California 25, which is an obscure little two-lane road that runs down the San Andreas Fault from basically Gilroy. It comes out at San Marcos on the 101. So you're running through endless ranch country,
right,
valley after valley after valley. The road gets progressively narrower. It finally comes down to one very poorly paved lane before you hang a right and climb out of the fault to go out to the river valley at San Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first day. That night, you come down, La Cuesta Grade down into San Luis. And
I can picture that.
Yeah,
that's
coming
big downhill.
That's a huge downhill, and that's your finale for the first day. And then we would get people up at 4 a.m. the next morning, and make you ride down to Grover Beach for breakfast, and that got everybody out and on the bike. So by the time you got up from breakfast, you already had about 25 miles done.
Mm-hmm.
So you only had 175 to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a very cool experience.
And what has brought you to this time and place, Pete, where you are, you know, an advocate for bicycling, bicycle safety, what education? What's brought you here, Pete?
I don't know, a series of bad decisions? it seems to be something that I'm cut out to do.
So you just kind of found yourself here and embraced it all?
Well, here I am now occupying a hitherto unused public building, the Metrolink building at the north end of town, basically up to my armpits in bicycles.
Renting?
Renting and providing service and some retail support for cyclists,
mm-hmm,
here in San Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very rewarding. Brewing up 4 liters of coffee every day, special grinds.
Yeah. Now, when people come in to rent a bike, that implies they don't have one. So maybe, can I assume they're new at it? Or
we get all kinds of folks who rent.
Folks, yeah.
We get folks from abroad who bicycle regularly, who are just looking for a bike. Maybe they want to rent a bike for a week. We have flat bar road bikes for people who want to go out and explore this amazing place where we live. Here in San Clemente, we know that some people on a weekend will drive 100 miles to come park here just so they can ride down to Oceanside, because the ride through San Onofre State Park and down through Camp Pendleton and down through Oceanside, the bicycle-friendly community of Oceanside, is so amazing. From our location in North Beach, you can ride to the Metrolink station in Oceanside. It's only 26 miles. Some of the most beautiful coastal bicycling you could ask for.
Yeah,
well,
I'd love to do that.
You've never done that?
No, I've never done that. No.
Down through the old Highway 101, which is basically now a 4-lane bike path. Then you get on the train and you come back. You're back in 20 minutes. So you have this one-way 26-mile ride, almost always with wind at your back. It's an amazing experience.
No, you can't beat it. Now, I'm curious. I'm thinking of a question. You're setting somebody up on a rental bicycle. You have an opportunity to say some words of advice to them, Pete? What do you say? What can you convey in the few seconds that somebody might listen to you?
The only thing we can do is try to get their saddle height up so they don't hurt their knees.
Yeah.
Yeah. The folks who want to rent cruisers are they're in that six-year-old mode.
Yeah.
And they're there to have a good time and to enjoy some bicycling, and we're happy to facilitate that. We have a coastal beach trail here, a shared-use path where all they have to do is dodge the dog walkers, the stroller pushers, the runners with the iPods in their ears, and just have a good day in San Clemente. So that's
it's easy,
all,
then. Huh?
Yeah, let's try to get their saddle up where it belongs. It's about all I can do.
I borrowed my sister's bike in Portland a couple of weeks ago, Portland, Oregon, and even her pink helmet. And everybody has wanted to see the picture of me with a pink helmet, but I don't think we took one. And I had to adjust the seat height a couple of times, and I came home with really sore knees.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that is important. But how about as we're moving to wrapping up here, Pete, I wanted to, this is an opportunity. This audience would love to hear from you. What? Maybe for somebody, I hear from some that are thinking about getting back on a bike, have just recently got back on a bike. What advice for somebody thinking about getting back on a bike might you have?
Well, I'd have to do a little probing and find out where they're really at.
Yeah.
You know,
ask a question or two first.
Yeah. Find out, they're motivated by some imagined experience, and we need to understand what that might be. That may or may not be a goal, but in order to encourage people in bicycling, you want to deliver to their expectation as much as possible. So we need to know what it is they picture themselves doing. The amazing thing about a bicycle is, without even asking it to, it will expand your horizons. It will take you a little farther than you thought you would go. And when it does that, it produces for many people such a profound sense of satisfaction, a realization that you could do and see more than you thought you could. The amazing thing about bicycling for utility reasons, for instance, is you get more fit whether you want to or not. You inevitably become faster, more capable, more efficient, even if those goals weren't in mind when you started riding. And if you stay open to the possibilities, bicycling can take you to some amazing places. Just don't resist it, you know.
That's very well said, Pete. Well, last thoughts, Pete, as we wrap up?
What a gorgeous day it is here. Wouldn't it be nice to go out and ride?
I know it. Perfect day. No wind. That's what I'm always looking for at midday like this. No wind today.
Well, you do know that if you start out on a windy day, that you're supposed to ride into the headwind in the beginning, right?
Right.
Yeah. Have you ever ridden up Cove Road?
No. I've never been in this neighborhood before, Pete.
Golly.
Yeah.
I would suggest you come down here and take a ride.
Yeah.
A lot of the problems, a lot of the challenges that we have here in San Clemente, I think we share with Newport Beach. We do have Sherrows down on portions of the Pacific Coast bike route here. That's satisfying for me, but more important than that, it's good news for bicyclists. We're working at creating some other facilities that are bike-friendly. San Clemente, as far as I know, we don't have any plans to become a BFC, a bicycle-friendly community. But by the time we get through here, we probably will have met most of the challenges. We have a former planning commissioner here, Brenda Miller, who's been very active. She created a group called Pedal for bicycle and pedestrian interests. And she is working nicely with city staff to develop some great facilities here.
I'm picturing in your bike rental facility, Pete, you've got a blackboard with some notice of an upcoming ride.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you do those kind of structured rides?
Oh, we try to get at least two out a month. There are no drop rides.
What does no drop ride mean?
Well, that means you run once you're brung. Anybody can show up on anything with two wheels, basically, and we'll head off toward a destination that isn't physically challenging, particularly. And the object is for everybody to go and have a good time. It's not like your club ride where the object is to go out and see how many people you can blow off the back.
I'm well suited for a no-drop ride myself.
Yeah, well, yeah. A lot of it is the social aspect for sure. And there's something about bicycling. I don't know whether it's the endorphins or the shared challenge or what it is, but it tends to break down barriers. It breaks down age barriers very well, as you've noticed.
Yes.
Young people who are meeting physical challenges have a great deal in common with older folks who are also meeting physical challenges at the time. And there is a brotherhood or sisterhood that develops between cyclists. It kind of melts age differences. One of the few things you can do, I think, that makes that happen. Bicycling dissolves barriers. We have people who bicycle through town from abroad who are doing Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, or they're just riding from Seattle down to Tijuana. They don't have to be fluent in English for us to understand what's going on, to realize what their needs are, what their expectations are. We can make assumptions and clarify with them what they want to get out of their experience coming through. And the bicycle becomes a way to dissolve those barriers between people. Mm-hmm. That's what makes bicycle touring so amazing. If you want to talk about bike touring, I used to lead tours in Europe for American youth hostels.
Oh, really?
And later on for commercial tour companies. We just had so many amazing experiences. You don't have to be on a bike at the time. If you're on a bike tour, sitting down to dinner means much more than it does if you're just getting off a motor coach. So all the experiences are enhanced by the bicycling, I think.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate being had, as they say.
Yeah. All right.
We're back in the studio, and I'd like to say thank you to my sponsor. That's BikeTiresDirect.com. BikeTiresDirect. An e-commerce site for all your bicycle gear, apparel, everything you need to equip your bike safely. Check them out, please. BikeTiresDirect.com. Well, of course, listeners to the show remember that I recently interviewed Lou Doctor, founder of Bike Tires Direct, and a recent visit to Portland. I'm headed back that way next month. Just nailed down another terrific interview in Portland, one in Seattle, too. So I've got some great content coming your way and entertain you and educate you as well. Oh, what can you do for me? What's in this for me? One thing is I'd like you to come to the website, cdmcyclist.com. I'll leave a comment behind. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your opinion, your interest in cycling safety as well. Okay. Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening, and good night.